One of them wanted to be the security guy. He claimed he was a security guy.
Heavens, Mr. Jarvis, you got me off screen there, adjusting my microphones. How you been?
I'm good. How about you?
No, I just got back from Vegas, and I was thinking of you the whole time, because you've never been to Vegas.
Right. Did you win some money?
I actually did win some money.
Oh, good.
I went to the cheapest slot machine you can find for a penny, and I won like $200.
Oh, okay.
Well, and then I went to another cheap slot machine and won $100.
Oh, wow.
And then I spent it all on things I shouldn't spend it on. But, you know, I was ahead for a while.
Okay.
Next time you got to go.
I'm going.
So, you know, went to Black Hat, and I wound up doing 43 shows.
Wow.
And I just produced them all today. So look for them on SoundCloud. Go to SoundCloud.com, look up Security Guy Radio or Chuck Harold, and you'll find all the shows there. And I put it on the girl site, Pinterest. So you belong to the Pinterest girl site, don't you?
Yes, I do.
You do not. Do you really?
No, I don't.
You should not have admitted that.
No, I don't.
It's not really the girl site. Don't send me any hate mail, all right? But it kind of is the girl site. My chair's too high. There we go. That's better. So what else is going on? Anything?
Not really.
All right. So now I got a very scary show today we're going to talk about. But first, let me introduce my co-host. I have a new co-host just came in. Donna Twella. Welcome, Donna. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Donna is a bona fide real journalist, not like the cheap Security Guy Radio show we have here. Tell us about your street cred. Tell us now.
Okay, so I am actually a producer-reporter. I produce a television series called Inland Unsold. It's exclusively for the Inland Empire.
Well, thanks for coming in. That was a fascinating show. Tell us more about it. It sounds like it's an unsolved mystery cold case kind of thing.
Yeah, I could write books about how passionately I feel about this television series. So I'm reaching out to the police departments in the Inland Empire. They are completely cash broke. They have very little resources available to them. And because I am a recent graduate, I got my bachelor's degree in media communications, I decided to become a producer and go into cold case. I've always been fascinated with cold cases. I'm very interested in crime, and it's just a fabulous medium, and I hope that it serves as a community service to the Inland Empire.
Excellent. Now we're going to do a show after this show with you only, but you're my co-host for this episode, and we're going to talk about a very scary thing, and it's biosecurity, right? And my guest today is Ryan Burnett, PhD. Again, more smart people on my show. I love it. All those brainiacs I had at Black Hat, really smart. And Ryan is the director of biosecurity and safety for at-riskinternational.com. Did I get that right, Ryan? Are you there?
I am here.
Well, there you go. Okay, good. Got it right. Yeah, so remember, go to the website. It's at-riskinternational.com. Now, we were talking before the show, and you were telling me the story about you went to a gas pump and used a little wipe to touch the handle. And I do this, too. When I go to the bathroom, I take a towel, and I use it to open the door and throw it away, right? And then I met Ryan a couple months ago, and he booked a show, and I kept thinking, well, biosecurity, that's interesting. We have not had a biosecurity chat, right? And today you mentioned community labs, and then I got really scared. And then I thought, you know what? It's time to lock all the doors and just give up because we're all doomed. Ryan, tell us about these community labs and what that means. It'll start the tone for the show.
Sure. No, thanks. You know, the community labs, I think to open up the dialogue, first of all, you know, as a scientist and former practicing scientist even, the community labs are doing some really good things. I mean, in concept, these are great ideas. They attract a lot of really smart people. We're driving biology and research into the hands of the public, and there are a lot of good things about that. I think that traditional research doesn't always do the best at community outreach, and these community labs, on the other hand, are doing quite a good job of it. So there's some exciting stuff going, and it's part of a growing movement called DIY, or do-it-yourself bio. So
that's a little scary sounding.
It sounds a little scary, I know. And, those of us in the security profession, we certainly step back and look at this a little bit differently. You know, we want to see the advances in research continue. We want the engagement of the public. We love the education that's going out to the public. What we do, you know, stay awake a couple nights perhaps thinking about is how safe and secure are these environments? Laboratories, by nature, we think of at least as being pretty heavily regulated with a lot of safety and security built around them. And the community labs, I think, are coming up in a time and an environment when those are some really important considerations. And so it's an interesting topic to discuss both from the scientific perspective as well as the security and safety perspective.
So we have community farming, we have community grocery stores, we have in that sense of the word, is this what a community lab is? It's somebody puts a bunch of equipment in a room and people sign up and share it and go in and use it. And they're mixing all their Petri dishes, and hopefully they clean up after themselves. But it's just basically a share, open source bio lab. Is that basically what you look at it?
I think open source is a great word.
All right. You
know, it is an intent to reach out to the community. Yep.
And let's talk about your background, right? Sure. Tell us what that PhD means and where you got it.
Yeah, sure. So I am a Virginia Tech Hokie by background, did my bachelor's and doctorate in biochemistry at Virginia Tech, went on to Vanderbilt Medical in Nashville for a couple of years, and moved into the private sector, started a division of an engineering firm that was solely focused on biosafety, biosecurity, and I've been in that business now working with laboratory design, policy and program development around biosafety, biosecurity, really doing everything that, you know, I can with a lot of my constituents. I should mention there are a lot of us out there in the biosafety, biosecurity field, and a lot of folks, you know, smarter and more experienced than myself, but a good collection of folks, and that's what we've been doing. That's what I have been doing for about the past 10 years, and worked in well over a dozen countries now on laboratory issues, threat reduction issues, biosafety, biosecurity for academia, healthcare, biopharma, biotech. So had a good run for about the past 10 years and learned an awful lot about the industry.
So when I think about biosecurity, the first thing that comes to mind is I'm a big pharma, I got a lab, or I'm a big, big geno or something, where you're doing genome splicing and things. But these are private industries that have a interest in protecting the intellectual property, and I would assume there's lots of security, and I would assume there's lots of internal controls, and I would assume we can't just go around cloning things without government regulation on those sort of businesses, right? So I felt okay with that part of the industry, thinking it's taking care of themselves. I'm not going to have a giant Ebola leak somewhere probably from that, but as we talked prior to the show, I can't remember his name, but the gentleman that made his own anthrax, the scare a few years ago, that was made in a community lab. Is that how?
Actually, the anthrax letters of 2001. That's you know, purportedly coming out of a federal laboratory.
Oh, okay.
So not a community lab. No, and I think it's worth saying that from a community lab perspective, we've never had a major safety or security breach as of yet. So I think that's these things are still new. I think most of the research that's going on in these laboratories is, fairly responsible and benign. People, you know, really want to get in and do the work that they've thought about. To give you a great example of a type of individual that you might find in a community laboratory, think about, and I can put myself in this spot, think about, a professor at an academic research institution, and they love doing the research, but now they're literally tied up, you know, running the business of their laboratory, and they really miss the research, and they've got great research ideas, but maybe their grant funding doesn't allow it. So where does somebody like that go? Well, if you're in a major metro area like New York or Boston or Los Angeles, then a community laboratory is a great place to go, keep your hands in the business and continue to do some research. So that's a great example of a, you know, type of individual. But we're seeing outreach now to people who don't necessarily have PhDs or, you know, backgrounds in biological sciences that are also interested in learning these techniques. So we're seeing a lot more people being attracted to this. And that's where I think some of our security concerns come into play.
Now, talk about regulations. There is not a lot of regulation in this space because it's a fairly new, evolving business or whatever you want to call it? Is that no, there's not oversight because it's not involving some kind of government restriction? It's just kind of
It is. So, you know, to give you a perspective of what the regulatory landscape in the U.S. looks like today, the primary piece of legislation we have is the Federal Select Agent Program. And what this does, this is a piece of legislation that really helps to regulate the use, possession, transport of a set of biological agents that may have a dual use perspective. And when I say dual use, one use is good old-fashioned biomedical research, looking for vaccines, looking for therapeutics. But these agents in the wrong hands could have another use. And that's where we start to get worried about things like bioterrorism, weaponizing biological agents. So the federal government created the Federal Select Agent Program. And essentially, if you work with one of the biological agents or toxins that is on this list, then you are subject to those regulations. So that includes a lot of laboratories across the country, academic labs, private labs, but that only applies to those agents that are on that list. So if you happen to be in a community laboratory and you're not working with one of those agents, then you're not subject to the Federal Select Agent Program.
So this reminds
that is the big piece.
This reminds me of the back in the 80s with all the drugs, right? So you change the molecular structure of... Oh, we got a call coming in, Jarvis. That's interesting. Well, at least somebody's calling. That's good news. So you change the molecular structure of a drug, and now it's not cocaine anymore. It's technically, chemically something else. Mm-hmm. Is there a danger in this part of the community lab business where you can, I'm not working with anthrax. It's anthrax light because technically it doesn't have two molecules. People play games with that kind of stuff?
Probably not that cut and dry, I would say, but you know where we have some concerns is I'll give you an example. It wasn't, but a couple of years ago, there were some papers published in some very respected journals, the Journals of Nature and the Journals of Science. And what these researchers were doing is they wanted to learn more about the pathogenicity and the transmissibility of H5N1, which is avian influenza, high pathogenic avian influenza, and of course in typical peer-reviewed scientific literature that we are required to publish exactly what we did. It has to be able to be validated by other scientists. So on the one hand, you're following the good ethics and practices of peer-reviewed biomedical research. On the other hand, you're kind of coming up with a recipe. Now, these things can be modified, sure. And that's a normal part of research is we look at biological agents and we try to predict what they could become. In fact, this is a big part of how we anticipate the need for vaccines, say even for seasonal flu, trying to figure out what's next, what could this thing turn into. Now, we can induce those changes in a laboratory, and that's exactly what these researchers did, caused a big stink. There was a lot of controversy over whether that should have been published or not, but ultimately it was published. But that was work that was done in regulated laboratories, subject to either, something like the Select Agent Program. These were not necessarily laboratories in the U.S. So in the community laboratories, yeah, is the possibility that somebody could be working with something that is not necessarily regulated, but can they, through molecular biology and gene editing and even gene synthesis, can they stitch together something that might be dangerous? That is real, and that is something that we worry about.
So, Donna, what I'm thinking is we get some guy at the lab, well-intentioned, that walks out to go home and has something stuck on the bottom of a shoe by accident, kind of like the toilet paper in the bathroom, right? And now you're dragging some bioagent all across Encino, and we got a major problem. So tell us about the physical security that goes on in these places, Doctor. Or is it, do they kind of self-police themselves? Do they hire people to do access control? Is it just kind of a come-and-go-as-you-please? Because typically in the science community, security is not viewed as something, well, you know what, in any community, people don't like security, period, right?
Right.
But certainly if you're involved in some intellectual creative process, it's kind of annoying to have security around. Do they self-regulate themselves in these labs?
Well, and before you answer that, Ryan, let me just ask you this. How do you identify where there is a community lab?
Oh, good question.
So there's a growing consortium of, what I referred to earlier as the DIY bio movement, and you can go to DIY bio. It's either .org or .com, and find out where these labs are, read about the interesting research projects that are going on. I mean, it is a bona fide research movement that is occurring. Yeah. So, yeah, it's all publicly available. And like I said, you know, as a scientist, I love seeing the research that's going on. And it's important to remember that, you know, 99.99% of what's going on in these laboratories is benign or for good purposes or for, you know, specific interests. There's that fine line between, I want to say, you know, not sounding derogatory, but ignorance, you know, and this doesn't happen just in the community lab, but we see this in other laboratories, major academic research institutions where we really focused on what are we doing in these laboratories and is this safe? Is this responsible? Does this need to be secure? So, while the community labs are new and they appear to have, you know, for the most part, open doors and they're doing some really interesting educational programs that is arming the public with more knowledge about these issues and these techniques and technologies, I think it's important to note that a lot of these concerns we have, you know, are universal across a lot of laboratories, not just the community labs.
So we're not going to find this lab inside UCLA. We're going to find it off campus, not associated with universities per se. In private buildings, office buildings, you know, a guy's basement. It could be anywhere, I suppose.
Correct. So they are community laboratories. So this is a lot of them are supported by donations. You know, we are seeing growing interest from university research partners, biopharmaceutical research partners, where there are shared research interests. But for the most part, they are independent community labs and what we call biohacker organizations that are popping up.
Now, is there any mandatory reporting required for the community lab as opposed to the university lab, which has all kinds of restrictions, I'm sure?
There, you know, surprisingly, not as many restrictions as you might think. From the community laboratory perspective, none that I'm aware of. I'll claim a little bit of ignorance on that. I think there's some encouraging things going on. For example, if you go to the DIY bio page, you'll see where you've got the option to click a link and ask a biosafety expert. So if you're a conscientious researcher in a community lab and you're curious about, well, am I really doing something safely or responsibly, you can actually get in touch with one of several on a panel of biosafety experts. And, you know, the American Biological Safety Association has done a good job of reaching out, building some partnerships there, some education there. The FBI also has done a good job of continuing to reach out. We feel that a lot of these issues and concerns that we have as an industry, you know, we got to start somewhere, right? It really needs to start by communication and kind of building that culture of safety and security. And that's no different than what we've done in academic or healthcare or biopharma labs for the past 30, 40 years.
It just seems different, though, that it's kind of out there and unregulated, so to speak, and, you know, free country and all, but it just seems that the potential for harm is so great. So at risk, international, when you're out doing a job, how do you step in? Do you step into these community labs and consult with them? Or I assume you consult with other labs besides just community.
We do. So, you know, we've got a variety of clients around the country and around the world, and they range from academic research centers to biopharma companies, vaccine manufacturers. We also work with the federal government on threat reduction capabilities around the world with respect to biosafety and biosecurity. So we've got a pretty broad spectrum of activities and clients that we're involved in. You know, typically the way that we like to start, I think, is usually somebody will approach us and they will say, you know what, we're looking at expanding a product line. We need to make a new vaccine and we've got some security concerns. We feel our program could grow, or, you know, the White House just issued a new memo that encapsulates a lot of research over the past couple of years about how we can be proactive to strengthen biosafety and biosecurity programs. We'd like to get up to speed, you know, at risk. Can you come in and work with us to do that? Or with the federal government. They might say, you know, we've done a lot of really tremendous public health efforts around the world and resource-challenged countries for a long time. But, you know, now there's starting to be a little bit of a security concern. We need to go in and evaluate the security programs that are at some of these international laboratories. So at-risk works to support those activities as well.
So here's what I'm thinking from my reptilian-sized brain. Nothing fancy here at Security Guard. It was just common sense. I'm thinking people have not used biological warfare throughout history because it probably doesn't work like everybody thinks it works in the movies. Am I wrong about that? It's not so easy to disperse this stuff and be effective with it.
You're right and you're wrong. I think that part of the reason that we have not seen any, you know, large scale biological attack is because it's not easy. You know, by nature, biological organisms need a host.
Right.
So, you know, your method of attack is really going to be built around that. They're not the greatest weapons. Now, it's not to say that nature isn't going to throw us a bone here at any point, something that could be used as a weapon. But historically, biological agents have in fact been used as weapons dating back to even medieval times. You know, for example, catapulting bodies of infected troops into your enemy's territory to cause an infection, not knowing what it is, but
right.
That's what happens.
Interesting.
Now, yep. So we have it. We have had historical examples, and you can read about them online. Some of them are very fascinating.
So do we think this is the next flavor of the day for terrorism, or is it just too sophisticated? They're kind of about bombs and bullets, but...
They are. I think that, you know, the terrorist perspective, I've had a really good working relationship with Dr. Jeff Moore of Mirror Analytics, and he knows a lot more on the terrorism side than I do. What I will tell you is that, you know, terrorism is really about how can we make the biggest splash. And yes, you know, bullets and bombs, those are scary, but I think there's something inherently terrifying about a biological organism. So do we have evidence to suggest that, you know, your major terrorist groups, your Islamist jihadist groups, are they investigating and, you know, trying to acquire these types of weapons? The answer is yeah. I think there's a fair amount of evidence to suggest that if they could do it, they absolutely would do it. I think that most folks in the bioterrorism field would tell you that if they can, they're going to. So we have to spend a lot of time thinking about how do we close that gap? How do we keep access to some of these agents away from groups like that?
Well, the community labs would not be my first place to try. That's where I'd be looking. I mean, what are we doing in the sense of, I mean, I'm going to get letters on this. That's fine. But, you know, what surveillance are we doing on community labs? Is anybody out there looking, paying attention, walking in, just doing a casual inspection of these things? I'm assuming it's on somebody's radar, but I'm fairly well versed in all these things, and this is the first time I've heard of community labs.
It seems like you couldn't even get insurance to cover
that's
an
what
activity
I'm thinking, right?
Like that.
Yeah, it seems like I mean, I am on the other side. I see your point on the research part.
Yeah,
all open source stuff is brilliant, right? That's the thing on the internet now.
It is.
Most businesses are using open source code, and it's coming up with brilliant results, right? So
yep.
I see the benefit on that.
It is, and I think like most science, you know, the benefits are going to be hugely, you know, outweighing any of the negatives. We look for that one bad seed. It is, and whether it's a graduate student in a regulated laboratory, in a federal select agent program regulated laboratory, or whether it's a community lab, we do worry more now about who has access to these agents than we did even 10 years ago, and certainly more than we did 20 or 30 years ago when we were really waking up to the concept of biosafety, trying to protect ourselves from the risks of the agent. So,
yeah, let's talk about that real quick. So there's a difference between biosafety, which is me making sure that I don't open the petri dish by mistake and kill everybody, a drama
yep.
strain kind of stuff, right?
Yep.
That's internal to the business. That's just good practices. And we were always concerned about that. We have to be. But we never were too concerned about outside threats back in the day. And that's just kind of a recent development in the last 10 years or so.
I think it's fairly recent. You know, I certainly don't want to paint a picture that it hasn't been on the radar. I think
sure.
it has. I think that, you know, most folks in our field, I think, view biosecurity as an extension of biosafety. And they're really two separate fields of practice. Biosafety is really based on the risk assessment process. If you have biological agent here, what is the risk that poses to the lab user, the public, the environment, and what precautions do we have to take to make sure those risks are mitigated, whether it's the laboratory design and the engineering controls, the personal protective equipment that we wear to protect our skin, our eyes, our respiratory system. So biosafety as a field of practice is something that has been growing and evolving for several decades now, and there are international organizations. The largest, as I mentioned earlier, the American Biological Safety Association, you know, just a tremendous wealth of knowledge there in the biosafety field. But we're starting to see that biosecurity is equally of a concern that we really have to worry about who has access to these agents. So it's not so much about, you know, where biosafety is, what risk does the agent present to us? Now, when we talk about biosecurity, we are saying, what are the threats to the agent itself? So we're really coming at it from a different angle. And this is where your threat assessment, I think, really comes into play. And here's where we have a gap, to be blunt. Where we have a gap today is we've got security professionals, we've got threat management professionals that are very good at what they do. But there's this biological field over here, and biosecurity is different than other types of security. So we need to work to bring together the threat assessment community and the biosecurity community so that we start to have more of an integrated process that I think will benefit community labs, academic labs, biopharma, international programs, et cetera. It's time for biosecurity to have its day, if you will.
Well, I can see if biosafety was the focus and you lock down anthrax and you lock down smallpox and it's in some vault at the CDC, that perspective is safety, so it doesn't leak and kill everybody, right? And of that, there's a security component. But what you're saying is now they're looking at that and saying, we thought safety and security were one and the same, and really they're two different disciplines. There can't be that many people in the field like yourself that handle that biosecurity side of it. I can't imagine, right?
You're right. And actually, from the, you know, strictly the biosecurity, really bringing a traditional yet creative threat assessment and threat management approach into the biological world. You know, I'm not going to swear by this, but I don't know of another group other than At Risk International that does that. We really try to bring those two components together so that when you walk away from that, you know, you've got a great biosafety program that is looking to mitigate the risks that the agents present. But, you know, now we need to think about what are the threats to your products? What are the threats to your biological agents? So a threat management based approach to biosafety and biosecurity is something that I don't think is being done in a very widespread or systematic way.
You ever read Deathwind, that book?
Deathwind.
So old
bits
book.
And pieces, yes.
Yeah, old book from the 70s. I think I read it when I was a kid, and it's some Russian scientist mails a teddy bear to his niece in America, and it wipes out, you know, 90% of America. It was seemed very authentic, very interesting.
So I have to ask, where is this list where you can actually obtain?
Yeah, where can people find those things? Maybe I'd want to know that the old Carl's Jr. down the street is now a biolab. I should know that just to pay attention, you know.
So I think if you're interested in the community labs, obviously, you know, get involved in DIY Bio, and I think they send out emails and newsletters and things. It's a very interesting forum from the science perspective, but, you know, the community labs are certainly not hiding themselves. Now, the laboratories that are regulated under the Select Agent Program, that is information that's going to be a little bit harder to come by. In fact, this is where things get a little bit dicey in the sense that all containment laboratories in the United States that work with select agents, you know, we know where those are. They are registered either with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention or the U.S. Department of Agriculture, depending on the type of research and the agents you're working with. But you can still be a high containment lab, a BSL-3 laboratory. And as long as you're not working with one of those select agents, you have no obligation to report yourself to the federal government.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, why would you have that high containment if you're not doing something like that? Why would you have it?
You know, so if you look at the list of biological agents and toxins that are considered select agents under that under the codes of federal regulation, there are about 70 or so, and give or take, it changes periodically as things come on and go off that list. But if you're not working with one of those agents and yet you still need the engineering controls and the practices that a high containment laboratory will offer you, then you need those controls. So there are a lot of criteria that go into what is a select agent and what is just a not a select agent, a regular
right.
agent, but still needs that type of containment.
So as an old cop, here's what I would think. I would think I'd be out looking for a list of community labs that have that high level of containment, but don't publicly state they have, you know, I'm going to call them class one bios in them, like, you know, anthrax and things like that. That might be an indicator that they're cooking something up. Well, why else would you make it so secure? It's a lot of money to invest. I'm assuming these things aren't cheap to produce, a lab with all this equipment. You got to put some money into making this stuff, right?
You do. I mean, there's money in the equipment. There's money in the reagents and, you know, obtaining the stocks and things like that. I think that the focus of the community, first of all, I should also say, I don't know of a community lab that has a high containment laboratory. So,
well, that's good news.
Yep. So at least there, that tells you, you know, the intent is not to work with agents that really need those types of engineering controls, which is good. That is a good thing. So those tend to be pretty, pretty difficult and expensive to build, to maintain, to operate. They do require a lot of training to operate in. So, so we don't have any, to my knowledge, we don't have any, you know, public or community high containment laboratories. I think what we want to focus on is really building that culture that folks, community, and the folks who lead those community laboratories have a healthy respect for biological safety, biological security, so that they can build their own programs the way that any other research institution would. What is their culture of safety and security? And that's something that's going to, you know, continue to take some work. But like I said earlier, I think we've already seen some good strides in that direction.
Dr. Ryan, give us your website.
The website is www.at-riskinternational.com.
And at riskinternational.com without the dash in it, to say it out loud. And
yep.
Dr. Ryan, PhD, Director of Biosecurity and Safety for At Risk International.
Correct.
Doctor, fascinating show. We're going to take a quick change of cameras and a break, and we're going to do another show with Donna about her Inland Empire show. And you're welcome to stay on and listen in
all
and
right.
Inject some
Thanks
questions.
Very
How about
much.
That? Sound good. Thanks for coming on Security Guy Radio. So we'll just keep rolling. All right. Do I get another music start? Just Jarvis, just kind of go. Okay, good. That's good. That's where we're starting. Donna, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Donna Trella, producer at large for K. Give me the call letters for the channel.
KVCR.
KVCR in San Bernardino.
Yes, it's
your part local of the public.
Public, yes, it's
TV.
PBS Channel 24.
All right, now tell us about your background.
My background. So, when I first came to America, I started a business. I was in the securities and insurance industry, and guess who came along? Bernie Madoff, and changed the entire planet, turned it upside down, and I decided to go back to college, change my career, walked away from my business.
Wow, well, good for you. That's amazing, especially when you're in a different country and you're starting over. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
So you got into producing. How did you do that?
Well, I actually went back to college and I decided I had no idea what I was going to do. Ended up in a lighting and cinematography class in the old studio at KVCR. And I had one of those epiphanies. I had one of those moments where I just knew I was in the right place at the right time, heading in the right direction. And 4 years later, I've been producing, reporting, but now I'm independent.
All right. So tell us about your show that you're producing for the TV station.
So Inland Unsolved was born actually from I met a chief engineer at KVCR, and he put a story on my desk, and it was to do a story with the Rialto Police Department, who were volunteering their time for 14 weekends straight to put on a pride platoon, which was for at-risk youth in Rialto. We're talking about children who were finding themselves being arrested for numerous crimes. And so I decided, yes, I'd take on the story. I ended up doing a documentary. It was called Rialto Rising. I followed these at-risk youth from through all the 14 weeks. And as I was there documenting their progress, I got to talking to Lieutenant Dean Hardin of Rialto Police Department. He told me how he really wished that we had more television coverage in the Inland Empire, that we got very little exposure, and that he would love to see a cold case. And I got to thinking about that, and I went to my boss and I pitched it, and she said, sure, if you can get the money for it, you can put on your own show. And I decided to call it Inland Unsolved, and it's specific. The premise is to work with police departments across the Inland Empire to offer the show to them at no charge to them. And the whole premise, though, is that the stories must come through a detective. So I'm offering this opportunity also to members of the public,
right.
but I want them specifically to work with detectives
sure.
because this is all about factual information. It's about providing the information that the police want out or exposed to the public to bring in those tips and information that they so desperately need. On some of these cold cases go back decades.
Yeah, and I came up with that. I registered Cold Case Radio years ago, and I thought about doing what you're doing. Because the police only get sound bites on TV. Right?
Yes.
They get 30 seconds, 2 minutes, here's the case. What if they had an hour to sit down and lay the whole case out and tell you all the little secret things?
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe somebody's listening saying, oh, yeah, I remember that. Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant idea. Now, do you find any resistance from the police officers, though? Because we're a little bit of a kind of a girded group, right? We like to guard things and not tell you the whole story. Maybe for legal reasons. Maybe you can't tell everything about the case because it might tip something off. But how does that work with them?
So far, as I've been building relationships, so Inland Unsolved is only 1 year old. So I've been working an awful lot in trying to build relationships and build that trust with police departments. And so far, yes, you're right. They let me in very slowly.
Right.
It's I can see the guarded nature. But very slowly, as I come through with my promises, if I say to them, I'm not going to record anything until we agree that you're ready to go on the record with whatever you say, because
right.
as soon as that tally lamp is lit, it's my information, right? So they understand that. Second, if we have a discussion off camera about anything that they want to tell me to help guide me in how I put the piece together, how I shoot it, how I design the way the film looks, how I design the way the program looks, I take that away. I keep that entirely confidential, and I've proven that time and time again. I'm working now on my fifth segment.
Okay.
Again, it's only a year old. These relationships take a lot of time, and
sure.
there's more than just the police here at play. See, as a producer, you wear many hats, as you know. However, I'm not alone in this. I have a team behind me. So who are my significant others? Well, I have the district, the San Bernardino Community College District that's behind Inland Unsolved. Why is that important? Why do we care? Well, the district owns KVCR, the television station.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yes. Okay. And also, they also control the Inland Empire Media Academy, which is who I actually receive my paycheck from
right.
up until this coming September. And also, all the monies that I'm fundraising or bringing in for Inland Unsolved goes through the San Bernardino Valley College Foundation, or otherwise it's known as SBVC Foundation, so that all the monies are tax deductible for the donations that are received, and it's completely transparent.
So we got to raise some money from you.
Everybody will see how the money is spent.
All right, so let's. Hey, Jarvis, you have that clip of the show?
Mm-hmm.
Let's watch a little clip of, you know what segment this is by chance? Well, just play the first one. Maybe we can see it. So this is a little clip from the show that Donna produces.
There are hundreds of unsolved murders in the Inland Empire, and we need your help in closing these cold cases. I'm Donna Trujillo. Another case that needs your assistance has gone unsolved for 23 years.
The Rialto Fire Department was called to an apartment fire at the Autumn Ridge Apartments here in Rialto. Upon entering, they extinguished the fire that was burning and discovered the body of Dolores Jara, who was 18 years old. Detectives later determined that Ms. Jara was a victim of a homicide. She was bludgeoned repeatedly and then set ablaze inside the apartment. At a subsequent autopsy, it was learned that she had smoke in her lungs, which tells me that she inhaled smoke, so she was still partially alive at the time.
Sergeant Stella is waiting for any tips or information you may have about the murder of Dolores Jara. Please call the cold case unit at 909-421-4990. And if you wish to remain anonymous, call the WE Tip hotline at 1-800-78-CRIME.
That's very nice. Now, Jarvis, I may need to get a new producer in here. Those are What's all those fancy graphics she's doing? Why can't you do all that?
It looks good.
Well, you got the voice, though. You got your voice to replace me in a second, so I got to be careful about that part. Very nice, Donna. So that now, is that a complete segment?
No, actually, I've divided this up into two segments.
Okay.
So the way to get the maximum exposure for each cold case is to do a short piece like that. It
right.
was a minute 30. And my program manager at KVCR has promised me that he's going to run it as many times as he can during a week during prime time. So
right.
he can fit it in between
so
half hour.
It's like an infomercial kind of.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Cool.
And then there's the half hour show where six of these cold cases will be compiled. It will be re-edited to summarize, and I'll bring the detectives into the studio. We have a monitor. We also have a very large set, and we'll have the detectives talk about the cold cases, whether they were solved or are still unsolved, and whether they need public assistance. And also another part of the show, which is an incredibly important component. This show is all about tips and information. It's about getting the public to be motivated enough to respond with in any information they have. How do you do that? Well, the WeTip is a fantastic organization. You know yourself.
They're national.
Yes, they're national. They bring in tons and tons of tips every single year. But not every police department subscribes to that. That's the number one.
I didn't know that.
That's the number one problem.
So, if you're not subscribed and I call it, they're not going to forward the case to...
Well, by law, they have to.
Yeah, yeah.
But the problem is it has to be filtered through the sheriff's department.
The county first, and the county sends it out to the local PD, hopefully.
Hopefully.
And hopefully timely.
Yes.
Oh, that's a problem. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that's the number one problem.
All right.
Fantastic organization, but here's the deal. Police know that social media is a major factor in crime today. Crime has changed, right, because of social media. And they're actually perpetrating crimes through social media, things like Periscope. Periscope is like a live streaming where there's actually crime being committed. It's being streamed live. And as soon as that signal goes off the air, there's no information. It's not traceable. So how do we turn the tables on crime? Well, one of the things I want to educate the public on is how to use social media so that, number one, you don't have to be worried about the fact that if you're calling WeTip, somebody can audibly hear you. So, number two, the best thing to use is social media. Are you going to use Snapchat to convey information? Are you going to tweet Dolores Hara's name? You just saw Dolores Hara.
Right.
Are you going to hashtag Dolores Hara and then give Inland Unsolved the information or do it directly to the police station? There are many ways. You can take a snipping tool on your PC. You could take a picture of somebody's Facebook page who you happen to know is the perpetrator of a murder,
right.
And you can share that information. There are many ways. That's one of the things I want to do is educate the public on how to give tips and information through complete anonymity because your fingers are silent.
Right. Now, there's a lot of police officer friends listening, so I want to give people some contact locations to donate to the show because The college funds it partially, I suppose?
The college has, actually the district has been funding my position. That funding actually ends in September.
Right. Oh, okay.
So I'm now a producer at large, and I'm looking for...
All right. Urso, Snyder's, Hache, Gettigan, all you guys. Get your checkbooks out and send Donna some money, right? You guys, you're out riding your motorbikes, all retired now. Let's fund this show and help her get this thing going. So where will we go to give a donation? Give us a website or how we can get a hold of it?
So the website is www.sbvcfoundation.org, and there's a button over on the right-hand side where it says donate.
So maybe Jarvis can pull it up. Say it again for Jarvis.
So sbvcfoundation.org.
Okay.
And on the right-hand side, there's a donate button. And the most important thing to do here, because the foundation supports many educational programs, so there's a drop-down box when you get to the donate button. And if you can specifically earmark the money that you donate to Inland Unsolved. It has to be typed into a little box.
Okay.
Otherwise, it goes to the college.
Well, you got to make it more simple for cops. They don't like to touch computers. Gives them the hives or something. I don't know what to tell you. They're just old school, right? All right. Well, I'm very fascinated by this. Cold cases now, I think, are more solvable than ever with the fiber connecting everybody through social media,
yes.
right? Somebody always knows what happened.
Yes.
And sometimes people won't say anything unless you technically ask them.
Yes.
And I think a show like this really, it functions as somebody asking a question, right?
Yes.
And, you know, unless the police knocked on the door in the old days, people aren't going to get involved, but maybe they feel compelled to help out. So do we see that that link there, Jarvis? Do we find it on the site? We'll say it again throughout the show. We can find out. Now, let's take a look at another. Now, is this next clip, is that a longer segment or kind of the same idea?
It's the same idea. This is different a gentleman case. Who was murdered 30 years ago in San Bernardino.
And they're still working this.
And they're still working it.
How long do you think it takes, in your experience, how long do these guys work these cases? Forever? I mean, is it really an active cold case detective in most agencies now? Well, budget cuts, I'm thinking that might be the first thing they start cutting. I'm not really sure.
Well, let me just give you two examples. The city of San Bernardino has 17 detectives, but only two are assigned to cold cases. And the last number that I heard, an unofficial number, right, I heard, was that the city of San Bernardino, going back over decades, has over 700 cold cases.
700?
That's the number I was told.
Wow.
Now, police departments don't like to put out those numbers, and I apologize to the city of San Bernardino for
saying
that.
Well, thanks for coming in. Funding's now dried up. It's all over. I'm just kidding.
But, you know, the tragic thing is that they need other resources. They need tools in their
budgets.
Tool belt.
That's right.
To help them solve these cases. And if Inland Unsolved can help in any way, fashion, that would be the ultimate dream.
Sure. Now, are these mostly murders that are unsolved in these cases?
These are murders. So let me also tell you the second point, the Rialto Police Department. The cold case unit was actually founded in 2013, and I was
2013 was founded?
Yes, 2000. Wow. It was funded in 2013, and the now Lieutenant Paul Stella just told me on the telephone a couple of days ago that they've actually solved 6 cold cases, and he's telling me, I'm not a police officer, but he's telling me that is a very good number since 2013.
I would think so, yeah.
So again, I'm hoping that Inland Unsolved, I've done 3 cases with them, I'm hoping that I'll be able to add to that number.
Have you got any tips, whether good or bad, on those cases from your show?
All he would say to me, because you know how police officers are, is that, you know, with the help of not only Inland Unsolved, but other media outlets, he believes that they have received tips.
Oh, that's excellent. All right. Jarvis, you got that other clip pulled up there? Let's take a look at this other segment. Very professional looking, by the way. Do you do all this graphic stuff?
There are hundreds of unsolved murders in the Inland Empire, and we need your help in closing these cold cases. I'm Donna Trujillo. Charles Bull was murdered in 1985, and his case has gone unsolved for 30 years.
Mr. Bull was found on September 29th, 1985 at about 5:30 in the morning by a passerby. The passerby saw an RV southbound on Riverside Avenue from Casamalia in Rialto. A few days later, his RV was discovered in the city of Rubidoux.
And it was all, when they went in, it was all bloody and everything, so indicating that he was killed inside his RV.
Why did Charles Bull take a side trip to San Bernardino? And what was so important there that it cost him his life? Police recovered $9,000 in cash in the vehicle. Was this the motive, or was this something more sinister at play? The Rialto Police Department is waiting to hear from the public with any information on the murder of Charles Bull. Please call the Cold Case Unit at 909-421-4990. And if you wish to remain anonymous, call the WeTip hotline at 1-800-78-CRIME.
Now, what else can you tell us about that case?
Charles Bull remains cold. He had no family. Nobody knew why he was visiting somebody in San Bernardino. It was completely off the track. I believe his journey originated from Oregon, and there's no brothers or sisters.
There's
no children.
Huh.
It's truly a cold.
And all that cash left in the RV.
Left in the RV.
Interesting. Very interesting.
In the fridge.
Oh, and that cold cash.
Exactly.
So how do they even begin to work a case like that?
Well, the television exposure, you hope that there's somebody out there who's watching KVCR and remembers.
Well, they watch in Oregon.
Remember somebody named Charles Bull.
We got a lot of listeners in Oregon. Maybe we'll get something out of that. If that's where he came from.
That's where he came from. Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me how, if you can, what's your budget for a show like this? What's it cost you to produce a segment?
Well, each segment costs about $5,000.
Okay. Because? What are we paying for?
Okay, so you're talking about the camera and editor. You're talking about the producer.
Right.
You're talking about travel. You're not talking about paying for anything else because I've got all those things from my relationships. I've got the camera equipment covered.
Yeah.
I've got the studio covered. I've got the office space. All of that is covered. This, all I need to keep this show going is enough money to pay two salaries and the travel expenses. Everything else is taken care of.
All right, you guys heard it. Culver City, San Gabriel, UCPD, all the places, LAPD, all you guys. Let's help Donna keep the show on the air. And maybe if you guys have some cases. Garrido, I know you got some cases that you didn't solve, even though you're an ace detective. Maybe you can call Donna and we can extend the show a little bit farther out west and maybe pick up a couple of cases like that. Now, you've been doing producing for about 4 years now?
Yes.
And anything else on the horizon where you want to go with that career? What you want to do with it?
Right now, I'm so focused on Inland Unsolved. I see such a need. And the more I speak to detectives and different police departments, the more I hear about budget woes and the fact that they just don't have enough detectives to handle their caseloads.
Right. So going out and getting social media connected to the police departments is often very effective mm-hmm. for all kinds of reasons. And I think, are you finding that the police officers are catching on to social media? An average detective nowadays is what? Mid-30s, 40-ish? They're not a rookie. Right. So they've been around a little while, but is this group or demographic embracing social media?
Yes, absolutely. I think the biggest problem is caseload. I just don't think they have enough time to invest in putting more resources into social media. And that is what I think is so important for Inland Unsolved in the half hour show, to invest a good portion of the show talking about social media, educating the public, let's say just educating the older viewers who don't know how social media works, and also showing the younger viewers, hey, Inland Unsolved is hip to how crime is taking place. Turning the tables on that, here's how you can provide tips and information through social media. I think that's vital.
Excellent. Now, give us your website for contribution. Give us your YouTube channel, I guess, is
yes.
where the show is now.
I have
give us information.
I have the YouTube channel. You just go to YouTube and type in Donna Trujillo segments, and you'll find the Inland Unsolved segment.
Now, so with your British accent, you better spell that name.
Inland Unsolved?
No. Your last name.
Oh, yes. Okay. So my last name is spelled Trewhella.
Okay. So that will find you on YouTube to show some
yes.
of these segments. All right.
Yes.
And then give us the website for the donations again.
So the website for the donations is www.sbvcfoundation.org. Go to the right. You'll see a donate button. It'll take you to another donate button on the lower left. And make sure that you type in that it's earmarked for Inland Unsolved.
All right, Chief Lawton, Chief Cook, I know you guys just retired, but let's help Donna get her show back on the air. Maybe you can help out through the Chiefs Associations. And thanks for coming on the show. I really enjoyed our visit, and I'm glad you can come in and help fill in as a guest host in our other segment. And you want to come and do it again, you're welcome.
Thank you
Anytime.
So much, Chuck. Right. I really appreciate it.
All right, Mr. Jarvis, we're going to go out a little early today because I'm exhausted from Black Hat. So thanks for tuning in to Security Guy Radio. And tune in the next couple weeks. We'll be playing all the Black Hat interviews that we did at Las Vegas, about 42 shows and 5 hours of interviews. Then we're off to As Is, where we will be broadcasting live from the event. Stay tuned for more information on that. Good night. See you next week on Security Guy Radio.